We have in 1 Samuel 25 an incredible account from the life of David and others, and many lessons to draw out of this. We'll see that David is tested again. David is tested again in a big way. We saw how he was tested last week in his interactions with Saul, and here we'll see David coming into another test, in which, again, and very much so, he is in need of the grace of God to deliver him through this testing, through this temptation. We see in this account, we see one of the many heroic women in the Bible and how her actions bring about great things in this account of what happens, and ultimately help towards the deliverance of David. We see the final chapter of Samuel's earthly life recorded for us. There are many incredible things here. So let's begin and look at this in several sections, because there's a lot that happens in this chapter. 1 Samuel 25. And Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him, and buried him in his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now, at this point in the story, there hasn't been a lot of mention of Samuel. His involvement in the events that are unfolding has been somewhat tangential to the core story, which has really shifted to David and Saul and their interactions together. But let's not forget what a significant figure that Samuel was in this period of history and of God's dealing with his people. Samuel was a prophet leader of the nation of Israel. And he was really the last of his kind in that sense. He was like Moses before him, which by the guidance and will of God led the people, received vision and revelation from God, and led the people by the word of God. He was neither a king like the kings of the nations or the kings that would come later in Israel. He was not a king, but he was a prophet. He was a prophet, and he was a prophet that led the people, even led them in battle at times. But he guided them by the word of God, by the revelation to him. And he was special in that sense as well, because you might remember how when it introduced God revealing himself to Samuel, at that time, it said that the word of the Lord, that God appearing to people by visions and revelation, that was precious in those days. I mean, it was rare. It had not been heard of. It was not normal for God in that time to be revealing himself the way that he did with Samuel, to whom, at least on several occasions, God spoke to him in audible voice. And so Samuel is like, in many ways, he's like Moses before him, who was a prophet who led the people. But Samuel grew in his old age, and he was unable to continue to lead the people, and his children after him were not as faithful as he was. They were not as just and wise leaders like him before. And the people cried out, and they wanted a king like the kings of the nations. And that initiates this kind of change in the way that Israel as a people was going to be led. But here we see that Samuel was someone who is known and honored and respected throughout all the nation of Israel. It says Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house at Ramah. So when Samuel was not some obscure figure, but he was prominent among the whole nation of Israel. And so at his death, he's honored. All the people come together. They mourn his death and they bury him. And with this, we see the end of Samuel's earthly life. Now, Samuel does come up again later in this story in a very strange way. But as we will see, but as far as his life on earth goes, this was the end. And so we're going to have further unfolding now of what happens with David as David rises up to be the new leader of Israel. And this next part begins with the description of this man. There's a man named Nabal, and Nabal means fool, but it means fool in a sense that carries with it a kind of evil along with it, like an evil fool. Not just someone who was silly, but someone who was evil in his doings and foolish in his heart. That's actually what his name means, or one of the ways his name literally could be interpreted. And he is going to be a central figure in this next event that unfolds for David. And as I said at the beginning, this becomes a test for David. David is going to be tested along the way in various ways. And we saw last week how David was tested in that he was face to face with the possibility, the opportunity to kill Saul, his mortal enemy who was trying to kill him, or at least Saul was an enemy to him. And David had the opportunity to kill Saul and to take matters into his own hands in terms of destroying his enemy and grasping hold of what he ultimately was destined for, which was to rise up as king of Israel. And so he was tested with, would he grasp that on his own terms, or would he trust the judgment of God and the timing of God in what he was doing? That was the nature of that test. Here we come to another test. Verse 2. And there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel, and the man was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Now, by the terms of life in that time, this was a lot of wealth. This was a lot of wealth. And this is a lot of food. He's shearing sheep. This is a lot of wool. This is a rich man. He's called great. He's great. He's very mighty in terms of his wealth and his possessions. And this is how this man is introduced. He's also presented in this way so that we would see that the means that he has at his disposal are very abundant. He has much. He has plenty for himself and far beyond himself. And one of the lessons that we ought to learn as we understand God's concept of wealth and of justice, we see that to whom much is given in this life, much is required. That God, what God has given us, it is our obligation and our responsibility and our privilege to use what God has given us for good in this life. And what God has put under our hands, at our disposal, it is incumbent upon us, it is our responsibility and our opportunity to use what God has given us for good and not for evil. And so this man has been given much in terms of his abundance of wealth. Now, the name of the man was Nabal. And a note about names, I've often pointed out what the names mean. And most of the names, it seems like, in the Hebrew had some kind of literal meaning to them that they carried with them. And it's probably not too much different today. Even many of our names have a meaning that linguistically that they go back to. But people don't maybe think about that meaning as much today as they did in times past. But they thought very significantly about the meaning. Sometimes the names could have more than one shade of meaning because language is very complex. And so a word can have different meanings to it depending on the context. So whatever the intention was in naming Nabal this name, his name, one of the ways that it was interpreted was a fool, an evil fool. And the name of his wife was Abigail, which means something like the joy of her father, the joy of the father. And she was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance, but the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. So we have now these two, husband and wife, Nabal and Abigail, and they're contrasted with each other because she is presented to us here as what we know about her so far. She's very wise and she's very beautiful. And Nabal, on the other hand, he's churlish and he's evil in his doings. So he's a very difficult person. He's the kind of person that everybody just hates to have to even talk to him, even interact with him, because he's just difficult in everything that he does. He's surly. He always responds to people harshly. And to add to that, he's not good intentioned in what he does either. He's evil in all his doings. And we will understand more fully what that's like as this story unfolds, because this is going to demonstrate to us what we've been told in verse 3 about both Abigail and about Nabal. And it's going to come from their encounter with David. So here the scene has been set for what's going to unfold. And David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And David sent out 10 young men, and David said unto the young men, get you up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall ye say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace both be both to thee, and peace be to thine house, and peace be unto all that thou hast. Here is what takes place. So David hears that Nabal's sheep shearers are coming out to shear. Now, we were having a discussion recently. I think it was after church one day. We were having a discussion about David. He's out with 600 men. We'll see his 600 men here in this story. He's out with 600 men, and that required a lot of food. They needed food to eat. And how did they come up with this food? How did they get this food? Well, that was an important question, and all the more important if it came to them desiring to participate in a feast day. And this seems to be the occasion that takes place here. There's a feast, and David needs to feed all his men, and he's dwelling in the place where Nabal's wealth is. And as it turns out, David's men, these were men of war. These were soldiers. You might recall where these people came from. A lot of them were discontent. They were people that were distressed. They were people that were they were in debt, and they were in difficult circumstances, and they gathered themselves to David, and he became a captain over him. So these were tough guys. These were fighters. These were warriors. And here they are, hanging out in this area near where Nabal is, or where Nabal's, the people that keep Nabal's flocks and all his wealth. That's a lot of wealth that he's got out there, and those sheep and those goats. 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. And they're out there. And how do you think it would be for them if there's now 600 soldiers with David and they're living and dwelling in their midst? Well, as it turned out, when they were near David's men, they were always, throughout all that time, they were safe from any harm, from any theft, from any difficulty that would have come from people stealing the sheep or taking them, harming them in any way. Not only were David's men not a harm to Nabal's wealth, but they were a benefit to him in that they protected both his sheep and his goats and his men that kept them. And they were safe at all times. And this is what was happening. And it's also representative of what David says here when he sends his young men, he sends 10 young men. He says, go talk to Nabal and talk to him in my name. When these come, they come to Nabal representing David, and they come with a message that's characterized by, first and foremost, this one word, peace. They come with peace. And David pronounces peace upon Nabal and upon all that Nabal has. He says, peace be both to thee, and peace be to thine house, and peace be unto all that thou hast. Now, this word peace or shalom in Hebrew, is an incredibly significant concept throughout all the Bible story. And it is a very rich in terms of its meaning. It's a word that carries great depth to it. And it speaks about soundness and wholeness and peace, as we think about peace in terms of a harmonious relationship with all that is around it. And this was the kind of circumstances that David was wishing and desiring upon Nabal. He said, I want you to be in peace. In fact, when David and his men were among Nabal's things, they were at peace. They were protected from harm. They were protected from anything that would hurt them or destroy them. And this is what David pronounces. And in fact, this is not just words. And we ought to understand that too. To pronounce peace is not just about words, but this is about our way of life. And we ought to ask ourselves, as we consider this story, and we see the contrast between how David presents himself at first to Nabal and how Nabal responds, are we going to live our lives as people of peace, people that both desire and actively live out in a way to bring peace, to bring shalom to people around us? Or are we going to act in a way that makes others' lives difficult and troubled in various ways? So we have this set up before us. Well, David, as he presents himself as someone desiring peace for Nabal. And now, and they go on, they say, and now I have heard that thou hast shearers. Now thy shepherds, which were with us, we hurt them not, neither was there aught missing unto them, all the while they were in Carmel. So they were safe, and they were preserved, and they were unhurt, and nothing was taken from them all the time they were around David's men. They go on, ask thy young men, and they will show thee. Wherefore, let the young men find favor in thine eyes, for we did come in a good day. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand unto thy servants and to thy son David. And when David's young men came, they spake to Nabal according to those words in the name of David and ceased. So this is how David presents, and now we'll see Nabal's response. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants now a days that break away every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? So, Nabal's response. What is it good towards David? No, it's very disrespectful. It's very, in fact, churlish and evil in his doings as he's been described. He treats David as a nobody. He treats him worse than a nobody. He treats him as some kind of servant who's broken away from his master and is looking for a handout. And he despises David to his men. He insults him in a very rude kind of way. So who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Now, did Nabal know who David was? We imagine so. I mean, David's fame was spread all throughout Israel. David, remember, had slain Goliath. He had been the means by which God saved Israel from their enemies on at least one occasion, and one very famous one in slaying the giant of the Philistines, Goliath. So Nabal probably knew who David was. But he treats him with disdain. He treats him with contempt. He lives up to his name. And we imagine that this was not just out of any animosity that Nabal had towards David in particular, but most likely, as you'll see this unfold, this was how Nabal treated everybody. This was the kind of person that he was. He might have just insulted the wrong person, though. Remember who David is. David is a very powerful warrior. David is a man of war, a fighter, and he's got men with him. So this situation is about to deteriorate very quickly after this insult. So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him all those sayings. All right. So I said, this passage shows us David being tested again. And now this is where this test comes. David, we've already seen, has demonstrated his ability to wait upon the Lord and trust in the Lord in the face of difficulty and wait on God's timing rather than taking things into his own hands. He had the opportunity to kill Saul, and he didn't do it. He didn't do it, but in fact, he returned Saul's evil towards David with good towards Saul, and he recognizes that, and Saul himself recognizes that that's what David did. And now David is tested again. And I think we might categorize the nature of this test that David is being put to is on David's way to the throne of Israel. In that process of rising up to the throne, will he incur upon himself something that is sometimes referred to as blood guilt? Will he incur unto himself guilt for his actions, for living unjustly or lashing out in wrath, rather than waiting upon the Lord? We've seen that he waited upon the Lord in the test with Saul. But here's what he does here. And David said unto his men, gird ye on every man his sword. And they girded on every man his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And there went up after David about 400 men, and 200 abode by the stuff. David seems to be furious. David is reacting to what has taken place, and he's reacting in a way that, on some level, seems perhaps justified. I mean, he has been insulted. He didn't deserve to be insulted. He ought to be honored. He's a hero of Israel. He deserves more respect than he got. But ask yourself, as we continue reading, is what David is going to do, is he justified in this response? But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them. But the men were very good unto us, and we were not hurt, neither missed we anything, as long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields. They were a wall unto us both night and day, and all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know and consider what thou wilt do, for evil is determined against our master and against all his household. For he is such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. So now we have the picture being filled out of Nabal and what kind of person he is. Even his own men, from the mouths of his own men, we see his character being revealed. He's such a son of Belial. This was a way to describe a very evil person in the time. We've seen the phrase come up a few times. It came back up at the very beginning of the book of Samuel, when Hannah, the mother of Samuel, is praying in the presence of Eli, and she's praying silently, but her lips are moving, which is a very valid way to pray in certain circumstances. She's praying, her lips are moving. Her soul is overflowing with emotion and with feeling because she's mourning for her barrenness, and she's praying to God for God to give her a son, a prayer which God would answer. But Eli, the high priest who sees this, he thinks she's drunk, and then that tells us something about Eli's spiritual discernment that he lacked, but he thinks she's just drunk, and he says, And he calls her a daughter of Belial. Well, son of Belial is what Nabal has described here. And a man cannot even speak to him. He's the kind of person you couldn't even talk to. You couldn't say a thing to him. He was so difficult, so churlish, to the point that now his own men perceive that Nabal has brought this trouble upon himself. and upon everybody by insulting so severely David. And David is going to come with his men. And what's he going to do? He's going to fight them and he's going to kill Nabal and all the men. So, well, David was insulted, but I think this clearly does not really justify the reaction that David is having here. What David is about to do is he may have had reason for doing it. That is, he was mistreated. He was treated evilly by Nabal. He was done harm by Nabal, even to the point that David's men may now be at risk of going hungry because of not being treated well by Nabal, and he's been insulted. But nonetheless, David does not have just cause for killing Nabal and his men over what has taken place. And I've said before, David was not by any means a perfect man. He has many great qualities that we have learned from, but David was not a perfect man. And David needs, especially in this test, which he nearly fails, he needs especially the intervention of the grace of God to preserve him from making this dramatic error and ultimately bringing trouble upon himself by these actions. He needs the intervention of God, and it comes in the form of this woman, Abigail, that God uses to deliver David from his own ill-conceived actions. And then right as things start to heat up, right as this starts to get really bad, David's got, as I said, 600 men. 200 are going to stay. They're going to watch the stuff. And the other 400 got their swords on, and they're charging towards Nabal's house, ready to fight, ready for a fight. This is something they knew how to do. And Nabal's not a warrior. I mean, he's a wealthy man. He had some means at his disposal, and he's got servants. He's not a fighter. We know how this is going to end if something doesn't intervene. And right at that moment, we have this. But one of the young men told Abigail. They knew something about Abigail. They must have known from, they know the character of Nabal. They also knew something about Abigail. Nabal was a fool. She was wise. Nabal was churlish. She was prudent in her goings. And so they come to her and they tell her what takes place. And now we'll see in several ways how she intervenes in this situation. So notice these things about Abigail in how this unfolds. First of all, Abigail acts very wisely and decisively and quickly in how she responds. She sees a troubling situation comes and she acts quickly. Several words in what unfolds describe how she didn't waste any time in springing into action and intervening in this situation. She acts with wisdom. Also, Abigail acted with great humility in how she will step in here in this situation. She presents herself with a servant's attitude in her interaction with David and what unfolds. Also, Abigail acts with great bravery and courage in what she does. She is going to go out, step right in the middle of this heated, fiery situation, right in front of a charging band of David and 400 men of war, and she's going to step right into the middle of that situation. So she shows great bravery in doing so. She has no way of knowing, ultimately, for sure, how this will turn out. But she steps in, and she acts with wisdom and prudence, and she intercedes in this situation. She puts herself in between these two parties, and she intercedes. This is what she does. Verse 18. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 bottles of wine and 5 sheep ready dressed and 5 measures of parched corn and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on asses. And she said unto her servants, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she told not her husband Nabal. And it was so, as she rode on the ass, that she came down by the covert of the hill, and behold, David and his men came down against her, and she met them. Now David had said, so now we're going to get more insight into what David's thinking was in this situation. We think we know already what David's doing, but unless we're not clear, this is what Dave is thinking in David's mind. Now David had said, surely in vain have I kept all that this fellow hath in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that pertaineth unto him, and he hath requited me evil for good. Now, I imagine none of you have ever been quite in the situation that David's in here, where you've been out in the fields and your servants, your men have kept safe the sheep and the servants of a wealthy landowner. And then he returns you evil for good. You've probably never been in exactly that situation. But I imagine many of us have felt almost exactly how David feels here. Where you have done good to somebody. Maybe repeatedly. Maybe at great cost to yourself. Maybe at great effort to yourself. You have done good over and over again. You've treated someone with kindness, with fairness, with generosity, with abundance. And whether you expressed it or not out loud, you were hoping through that ultimately when it came down to it, your good towards the other would be returned back to you with good from them to you. And when it isn't, it's a great disappointment. And when it isn't returned good for your good, that's bad enough. But how much the more then when opportunity comes for the one to whom you have done good does evil back to you, how enraging, how infuriating is it to you? And I imagine many of us have been in that situation to some degree or another. And we would probably feel just like David expresses here. He says, basically, paraphrasing, he says, it was worthless for me to do all that good. All that good that I did was worthless. It was in vain. Because now, given the opportunity to have the good returned to him, he gets evil instead of good. That's a very human and normal way for us to feel. But was it in vain for David to show peace? To show shalom to Nabal in all those ways? Was it in vain? It's never in vain to do good rather than evil. Why? Because God sees. And God will reward what we do in secret. He will reward us openly. And this comes up again and again in what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. When he even tells us to return good. Even when evil is done to us. When he tells us to do the good in secret, to pray in secret, to give alms in secret, to do good, not because we're hoping for a return from the one to whom we've done good, but because we're hoping for our reward from our Father, which is in heaven. In his time and in his way. But I can understand how David feels and sympathize with how he feels, but it was not in vain. But this is how David feels. And when you feel this way, when you're overcome with this anger and this bitterness, you need the grace of God to intervene. You need God to send a message to you that would stop you in your path. He said, so that nothing was missed of all that pertained unto him, and he hath requited me evil for good. This is one of the worst feelings to be in, for you to do good and to get evil in return. So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertain to him by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall." David is saying here, in a almost seem like a vulgar kind of way, he's angry, he's upset, he says, "I'm going to kill all the men." Nabal, not just Nabal, he's not content just to put Nabal to death, he's going to kill Nabal and all of his men. And he vows to do it. So much more. So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertain to him by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall. So this is the state of mind that David's in. Why are we told this right now? Right in the middle of it describing Abigail's actions. So we would see, partly, at least, just how important what she's doing is, how important her stepping in here is, and the bravery that it took, and how critical this is that takes place. So, verse 23. "And when Abigail saw David, she hasted and lighted off the ass and fell before David on her face and bowed herself to the ground." I mentioned humility. We see here this humility that she takes on. She bows before David. She's very wise. She's very prudent. She's acting the opposite than Nabal acted. Nabal insulted David. Nabal belittled David. She elevates David. She humbles herself before him. "She fell at his feet and said, 'Upon me, my Lord, upon me, let this iniquity be. And let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience.'" Now, this is right at the heart. This may be the most powerful thing of all of what Abigail does. Abigail puts herself in the place of a mediator. And she's very prudent in doing this. It's a risk for her, because she is putting herself in danger, but she is very wise also in doing this, because she is hoping, perhaps, that if she could take the guilt of everything that's taken place upon herself, perhaps she is more likely for David to have compassion and mercy upon her than he's likely at this point to have upon Nabal. She knows how insulted he must have been by her husband's churlishness. And so she says, "Let this iniquity be on me." She puts herself right in the heart of this situation. She said, "Let it be upon me. And let thine handmaid pray, in thine audience, and hear the words of thine handmaid." And now we see her case that she pleads. She's very brilliant. She's very wise. She's very careful in what she says here. She says, "Let not, my Lord, I pray thee, regard this man of Belial, even Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, thine handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord, whom thou didst send." So she is, one, at one hand, she is beginning this discourse by showing herself sympathetic with David and David's position. So she's getting on his side. She's showing him that she is on his side, and that she was not aware of things that took place, with the implication that if she had been, things might have gone different. So she's opening up a window of hope to David. Now, this is a very difficult situation. Someone who is enraged, someone who's intent on doing something, it can be very hard to break into that. But she's breaking in by opening up a window of hope. By the way that she has phrased this, she's helping David to see that things could go differently. Things don't have to end the way that they started. There might be another ending to this. And so she's opening up that door. She's also being sympathetic with him by acknowledging what he has recognized already, that her husband is a fool and that he is the source of this trouble. "Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, seeing the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, Now let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my Lord be as Nabal. All right, now next, what she does is she indicates that the Lord has ultimately be the one at work to withhold David from shedding blood and from avenging himself. This is something that David should have understood. David was already in a position where he had the opportunity to shed blood and avenge himself against his enemy, and he did not do it against Saul. And so she's now putting before him the reality that he has now been prevented thus far from doing the evil that he had refrained from before. And now, this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. So in her presentation, she is providing a gift to David. She's pacifying his anger by providing him a gift. And there are times when a gift given at the right moment, at the right time, can be very powerful, can have a very powerful effect on something. In fact, this is all David wanted in the beginning, was he wanted this food for his men that they might be able to feast and enjoy these good things. I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid. Notice again, she takes, what has Abigail done wrong? She hadn't done anything wrong, but she takes the iniquity upon herself and she pleads on behalf of Nabal. She pleads on behalf of an evil man. And she takes the sin upon herself and pleads for forgiveness from David. Now just imagine this. David, put yourself in the mind of David for a minute and think about this. He's angry. He's been insulted. He's charging with 400 men ready to kill his enemy. And he pictures at the end of that, the object of his hatred, the object of his wrath is Nabal, this churlish man that has insulted him. And then on his way, halfway there, all of a sudden, standing in his path, is this beautiful woman speaking prudently, wisely, humbly to him. And imagine the power that must have had. Just imagine how what a dramatic effect this must have had on David. And now she's asking for his forgiveness. She's saying, forgive the trespass of thy handmaid. I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord fighteth the battles of the Lord, and evil hath not been found in thee all thy days. And now as she's coming to the conclusion of what she's saying, she's reminding David of one of the most important things, that the Lord is going to be the one that's going to set him up. She's reminding him of what it seemed like he had understood before, that the Lord is the one that's going to raise him to his kingship. And he needs to trust and wait upon the Lord. He needs to entrust vengeance and judgment to the Lord. He needs to look to the Lord. And she reminds him of this. Evil hath not been found in thee all thy days. Yet a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul. But the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out, and as out of the middle of a sling. I interpret this as her having an understanding of David's situation. She says, a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul. It seems she's speaking about Saul, that she knew what was going on. Perhaps everybody knew what was going on. This was very prominent. And so she's sympathizing with his case and indicating that she understands the source of David's case. Now, it seems like on the surface that David was very angry with Nabal because Nabal returned him evil for good. But there was somebody else far more important in David's life that David had done good to over and over and over again. who had returned evil for David's good, and that was Saul. And David had restrained himself from lashing out against Saul, but perhaps there's an element of David now that his lashing out is going against Nabal because he hasn't gone against Saul, but she reminds him here of how the Lord had been his strength and his guide and would be his victory when all was said and done. But the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. Kind of like David had slew Goliath with the sling. And it shall come to pass when the Lord shall have done to my Lord according to all the good that he hath spoken concerning thee, and shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel, that this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offense of heart unto my Lord, either that thou hast shed blood causeless, or that my Lord hath avenged himself. But when the Lord shall have dealt well with my Lord, then remember thine handmaid. Here now she brings her words to their conclusion, and she sets before David something that is so important, especially when you are in the midst of a difficult test in your life, especially one that has you emotionally charged up in rage or in some kind of emotion. It's important to be able to see beyond the current circumstances and put yourself past them and understand how your actions in this moment will look to you when you are looking back on them from the future. And this is what she does. She points David beyond this situation. This is small compared to everything that David will experience and deal with. She said, one day you're going to be king. God is going to defeat all your enemies. You're going to be looking back on this. And David, you don't want this to be an offense to you when you look back on all that God has done thus far. And so by doing this, she's trying to save not only Nabal, not only his men, not only herself, but she is ultimately through this saving David from himself by bringing evil upon himself, by bringing blood guilt upon himself through these actions. And that is ultimately how David interprets what has unfolded. All right, so that was Abigail. Now let's see how David responds. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, which sent thee this day to meet me. And blessed be thy advice, and blessed be thou, which has kept me this day from coming to shed blood and from avenging myself with mine own hand." How does David interpret what has taken place? First and foremost, he understands that it is the work of the Lord in sending Abigail right at the right time to keep David, to save David ultimately, not from Nabal, but from himself, from his own evil actions. The Lord has sent Abigail to meet him and through this kept him from, what he says, shedding blood and from avenging myself with mine own hand. For in very deed, as the Lord of God of Israel liveth, which hath kept me back from hurting thee, except thou hast hasted and come to meet me, surely there had not been left unto Nabal by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall. And so David acknowledges, in fact, that David did not pass this test on his own. That, in fact, if Abigail had not come out, David would have gone through with what he was going to do. So David acknowledges, in a sense, the sin that he would have committed had God not intervened by his grace and sent a mediator into his situation to prevent him from doing this. So David received of her hand that which she had brought him, and said unto her, "Go up in peace to thine house. See, I have hearkened to thy voice and have accepted thy person." And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he held a feast in his house, like the feast of the king. And Nabal's heart was merry with him, for he was very drunken. Wherefore, she told him nothing, less or more, until the morning light. Now, this example of Abigail coming out and mediating, of interceding on behalf of Nabal in the face of David is one of many examples in the scripture we have of this kind of intercession. And it's filling out a picture to us, as all things in the Bible are, of ultimately how we stand in need of a mediator. For us, in our case, it's a mediator between God and man. It's a mediator between us and God and God's just judgment against our sin. We stand in need of one to step in between and stand in our place. And as she said, let the iniquity be upon me, we have in our Lord Jesus one who, it says, took our sins upon him. And notice what it says. It says, David, he accepted her person. David accepted her person. And so Nabal is delivered from this destruction at the hand of David. And they're all saved from this trouble because David accepts her person, not because of Nabal's good actions, but because of the actions of the mediator. And we have in this, we have a picture of how we are saved, not because we deserve that salvation, but because our mediator and his person are accepted in our place. Now, so Abigail comes to Nabal. He's having a feast. He's drunk. His heart is merry within him. He's very drunken. So she doesn't tell him anything until the morning. But it came to pass in the morning, when the wine was gone out of Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. So she told him these things. What things? What did she tell him? Well, it seems like she told him these three things. First of all, that David was going to come, and he was going to kill him and everybody else. She tells him that. She tells him how she intervened and how she went and she gave the gift to David and she interceded and she told him the conclusion of it. How ultimately David was averted from doing what he was going to do. And so ultimately what she's telling him is the good news of what he was saved from, what would have been had she not stepped in. And it says when she told him these things, that his heart died within him and he became as a stone. And it came to pass about 10 days after that the Lord smote Nabal that he died. Now the judgment of God does not always come so quickly, does not always come so fast upon somebody's life, but we can trust judgment to the Lord. He says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. David didn't need to act in this situation. David didn't need to take vengeance against Nabal because the Lord would be his avenger. And we can entrust to the Lord judgment and vengeance. And he will always do what is right and what is just. Even if that means at times when he has mercy on the undeserving, it is God's right to do as he will. It says that he will have mercy upon whom he will have mercy, and whom he will, he hardeneth. Well, here, Nabal's heart becomes like a stone. 10 days later, the Lord smites him, and he dies. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord that hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and hath kept his servant from evil. For the Lord hath returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head. And David sent and communed with Abigail to take her to him to wife. Now, that might seem like this is and they all lived happily ever after. This is a wonderful love story about how David found his wife Abigail. But there's a problem. You might recall, David already had a wife. And this is a difficult truth that we'll see in the story of David and his son Solomon after him. How God had commanded the kings of Israel not to be like the kings of the nations. Now, for a king in the ancient East to have many wives it was a very common thing. It was not unheard of. It was the way of the world. It was the way of the kings of the nations. But God had commanded for the kings of Israel that they were not to multiply wives unto themselves. And in fact, it was not in line with God's design from the very beginning. When it says that God made the woman out of the rib of the man, it says that therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and be united unto his wife. Singular wife. But David takes Abigail to be his wife. And when the servants of David were come to Abigail to Carmel, they spoke unto her, saying, David sent us unto thee to take thee to him to wife. And she arose and bowed herself on her face to the earth and said, behold, let thine handmaid be a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. And Abigail hasted and arose and rode upon an ass with five damsels of hers that went after her. And she went after the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were also, both of them, his wives. But Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Phalti, the son of Laish, which was of Galim.